How are you feeling about Peter Drury being the commentator for the Premier League?
I mean, it's poetry, isn't it?
Here we are, brave Brentford, taking on the Arsenal elite. Here they are, Bukayo Saka, the hopes of a nation.
Yeah.
All right, mate.
He's quite epic, isn't he? Yeah.
And the World Cup for Japan! They have rewritten the history books in Germany.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Final Countdown, a podcast looking back at great finals within the game of football. I'm Lewis, here with my co-host Adam.
Hello there.
And we are beginning a new season now. We are getting back in the swing of things following a nice little brief hiatus for holiday. And we are now going to be focusing on the Women's World Cup. Obviously, one is fairly imminent for the 2023 Women's World Cup. So we thought we would give a bit of a brief history and a lead up to some of the
Counting down.
A final countdown.
Yeah. I mean, is it a countdown when we're starting from, or is it count up?
We're counting up to count down. We're counting up to count down to the 2023 final.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So for those that might be joining us the first time, this is a fun and educational.
Why did you use that?
I don't know. It's become our unofficial tagline. But it is worth saying that whilst we try and research as diligently as we can, Women's World Cups and women's football in general have not been covered in the same depth that men's football has been. So sometimes some of the sources are a little bit scarce. Sometimes they're not as well founded. So I'm just adding that caveat for this series.
I also think that, like, humbly, we're going on the journey that a lot of people are going on. Like, for me particularly, women's football captured me last summer or summer before.
Yeah, last summer.
And remember, we did a review of the Lionesses winning, and that really was the first time that I tuned in properly.
Yeah, sure.
So I'm not, you know, ashamed to say that. No. It's just what happened.
Absolutely.
But it's a very different thing now. So it feels right to kind of recount this. And part of recounting this history is seeing where it's come from.
Exactly, yeah.
To where it is now.
Which, there's going to be a lot of shocking things for people that may not know or may know the kind of history of women's football, both in terms of what the players have had to put up with, but also the kind of infrastructure that has or hasn't been around for them. But yeah, you're quite right, Ad. Like, this is part of the fun of these episodes and this series is going to be the education and the ramping up of the excitement of England, and I'm going to call it now, World Cup champions and Euro champions. We're going to do the double.
Literally just said something different off
air. Yeah, off air I said I'm very worried about our shoestring defence because we've got Leah Williamson out now. Millie Bright didn't even play in the
Would
the
you
friendly.
Bring back Houghton?
I would have done. But I'm not Serena Wiegmann, but I would have brought back Houghton because I'm not convinced by Morgan. I'm not convinced by Carter. And
it does seem strange, doesn't it, to have so much experience and not bring it back. Former captain who's still playing at the top level.
With this short notice, I understand if we had three or four games before the World Cup, giving Esme Morgan or Jess Carter kind of more game time would make sense if they are going to be the future. But we've had one game on home soil before we go away, and we've got, I think, one or two more games before the World Cup. I just think, bringing Steph out and, like, she's been...
But World Cup warm-ups are meaningless. Are you in agreement with me on that?
I agree with that in terms of, like, form, but I like partnerships and things, I think it does matter with combinations. Like, this is a back line that has never ever played together.
Yeah.
Where we had Greenwood, Carter, Morgan and Bronze. Like, that back line had never played together. So I'm kind of like, it serves purpose for that. Not like if you have a bad game in a warm-up game, it doesn't matter. It's more about just communication and familiarity. The amount of times against Portugal, Esme Morgan was just caught roaming upfield. It was like, what are you doing? Get back.
She's doing a Sol Campbell.
She was, yeah, exactly. But I need kind of Millie Bright in there to calm my fears. But all of that, we're not here to
to
review England's chances.
We're jumping back in time.
That's
not
right.
Not present day.
So it's your report today, Ad, so take it away.
It is. Let me take you back to the first ever Women's World Cup, which, can you believe, the Men's World Cup started in 1930. The Women's World Cup, the first one, was 1991.
Well, let's be honest, what about the women's temperaments? What about their personality? They would be in hysteria if they were allowed to play football. For the record, this is what was said.
That's good.
In the 1930s.
So anyway, we go to Guangdong in China.
Okay.
And it was November 1991.
Oh, a Winter World Cup then.
Yeah, so that last Winter's World Cup wasn't the first Winter World Cup.
No.
So I don't know, but we'll find out as we go, but I don't know if that was a regular date.
I know that looking ahead into my report next week, that a lot of the tournaments were kind of put on as and when they could. There wasn't wasn't that sense of like every 4 years, same slot each and every time, which obviously there is now. Like the Euros and the World Cup were in the same year for the tournament.
I mean, I guess in some way they're not thinking about TV audiences.
No.
They're not thinking about fans.
No, exactly.
It doesn't really make any difference when it was on.
Yeah, it's so strange that it is the almost afterthought that, okay, they're a legitimate women's nations now. They should probably have their own tournament. And that was kind of the only level of respect they got.
Yeah.
And past that, like you say, it wasn't believed in as a product that people particularly cared about or passionate fans, which is crazy, but it's what it was. It was, oh, okay, yeah, women's football is getting professional now. They're pushing for a tournament. Let's just give it to them.
Yeah, yeah. So only 14-day tournament, a 12-team tournament in 14 days. That seems incredibly sped through.
Yeah.
But that's what it was. So as I say, in China, with FIFA still reluctant to bestow their World Cup brand on the Women's World Cup, the tournament was officially known as the first FIFA World Championship for Women's Football
for
the M&M's Cup.
Oh my God. That is the most ridiculous title in the world.
So, and why... why would that be the product of a meeting where they're like, oh, don't call it the World Cup?
Because you don't want to cheapen your brand. Because this is what we're going to say. We've had a little bit of a break from really lambasting FIFA. We've kind of let them get away with stuff because we've been in modern times a bit more. And whilst we've highlighted some of their foibles, it is fair to say that the level of disrespect and arrogance that they have towards women's football hasn't lessened. That in the next 30 years that we're going to cover,
it's crazy.
It is just story after story of them treating it like it's a kid's birthday party.
Or the M&M's Cup.
Couldn't be,
and they might as well call it the Smarties Cup.
Well, like, this is it. It's not so much that like sponsorships play a big role. They play a massive role in the Men's World Cup.
Yeah.
But the idea that they would ever turn around and say, right, we are now contesting the Budweiser World Cup. Like, they would never let a sponsor have a title. It's just part of all of this. Whereas, yeah, it's like, oh, we'll only be able to sell the... we can't sell the rights or anything. We'll just bundle them with the men's, which is what happened this year with the TV rights when they finally got split for the first time and FIFA wanted to kind of pretend as though they really valued them, which is like, you never valued them. That's why you chucked them in as a freebie.
They can make money now. Yeah. That's the difference. So anyway, the first FIFA World Championship for women's football for the M&M's Cup made its debut in Guangdong, China in November 1991. An average attendance of over 19,000 per match.
That's great.
Was deemed a success. I think that is.
Yeah, it's a success.
I would have said under 10,000.
Which shows like that clearly there was demand for it and there was excitement for it even during its first kind of iteration, that people did want to go and watch women's football.
Yeah, even 30 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's really cool.
Yeah, it's great.
And while the USA has some catching up to do when it comes to the men's game, in women's soccer, they're equal to the best in Europe and could soon be at the very top. At the highest level, the national team approached the World Cup full of confidence after scoring 49 goals in 5 qualifying games.
So the 12 qualified teams were divided into 3 groups of 4, so fairly standard for a kind of major tournament. Set up, the top 2 teams and the 2 best third place finishers from the 3 groups advanced to the knockout round of 8 teams. So it only went down from 12 to 8.
Yeah, sure.
Which is kind of, I guess it's just the way it was.
You've got to get the most football out of a 12-team tournament, I guess.
So yeah, for only the first edition of the Women's World Cup, all matches lasted, you'll love this, only 80 minutes.
That final 10 minutes would have pushed them over the edge, really, wouldn't it? This is what I'm talking about. It's just the patronisation, the dripping, like, condescending nature of FIFA going, oh, the women, they can only run around for 80 minutes. That 10 minutes, oh, so frustrating.
It's quite shithousery, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You would think you were doing it on purpose. You would think that they're trying to, like, wind people up. But it's just literally in their head. They're like, oh, no, that makes sense because women could probably only run for 80 minutes.
It's crazy. That is crazy. So 80-minute match instead of the typical 90. 2 points awarded for a win. Both of these things would change in the following World Cup in 1995. So it was only this first World Cup as FIFA dipped their toe into this new kind of Women's World Cup world. All 6 FIFA confederations were represented with the 12 teams.
That's cool.
So quickly, if you're interested, Nigeria, China, Japan, Chinese Taipei.
Oh, interesting.
Brazil, New Zealand, Denmark, Germany, Italy, Norway, Sweden, and the USA.
So no England. No England in the first World Cup.
No England. So spread across the world. So I guess, you know, that's kind of good in that way, although Chinese Taipei was kind of a weird left field one.
Yeah, sure.
Not sure they made it again.
No.
But they were there on the first one. The American team really were the dominant force, along with a couple of the European nations. But they led with a forward line dubbed the Triple-Edged Sword.
I kind of like that. It's a bit cheesy, but I kind of like it. It doesn't make any sense.
It's a bit dope.
It literally doesn't make sense. But
you've got a triangle sword. How does that even work?
But yeah, I like the idea of trying to give them the nickname.
Mm. So it was the Chinese media, read into that as you will, that dubbed this nickname, okay, the Triple-Edged Sword. They tore through the tournament to reach the final of the first ever world championship for women's football, the M&M's Cup.
As it will now be referred to every time.
I can't say anything else. So Michelle Akers, Karin Jennings and April Henrich, or Henrichs, were the Triple-Edged Sword of USA.
I'm hoping that's a mistranslation from the Chinese media and it's something like trident, because the trident sounds much better and much more threatening. So I'm going to assume it's a translation issue rather than Triple-Edged Sword.
I've read that quite a few times, so I think unless your Chinese is better than most publications.
I don't like to boast, but yeah, I learned my Chinese from google.com. I'm certain that's how you pronounce it.
Yes, I'm sure. Google. So anyway, Akers, Jennings and Henrichs combined to score 20 of the 25 bloody goals hell for the USA team, including all five in the semi-final victory over Germany.
That is comprehensive, isn't
it? It's not bad, is it? Yeah.
That is great. That is rivaling MSN. I love that.
Rivaling. Hang on, what do they call Tevez, Ronaldo and Rooney? Was there a name for that?
I don't know. I don't ever remember there being a name for
RTR. Just done it.
Sure, okay.
TRR. RRT.
Rrt. I think we're losing our minds.
Yeah, we'll leave that one, yeah. So anyway, we just need to back up a little bit to kind of set the scene with the American team in particular, because they really were the headline act of this World Cup. And in a way, for quite a while, the American women's team kind of set the standard, and still do in many ways, yeah, for women's football. So almost, if you could imagine, like Brazil set the standard early on in the kind of early World Cups for the men's, USA were that for the women's.
Yeah.
So USWNT was created, which is the Federation over the Women's Football Team. It was created in 1985, so only 6 years before this. Yeah. Just a year later, the Hall of Fame coach Anson Dorrance joined the program after already leading the North Carolina Tar Heels. You heard of those?
The names are dreadful.
American names are cracking, yeah, aren't they? Yeah. The North Carolina Tar Heels to four of their 22 national championship titles.
The Man United of the women's MLS.
Yeah, we're just giving you like things that you can cling to. So the Tar Heels, yeah, that's Man United of the 90s.
Just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
It does, yeah, exactly. Anson Dorrance, he brought with him nine players who had been on his UNC team, including Henrichs, Christine Lilly, and Mia Hamm.
Yes. Now we're talking. Royalty.
So building on that foundation with a core of young players, the average age of the starting 11 in 91 was 23.
Wow.
Dorrance unveiled his now legendary 3-4-3 system, which was received with massive criticism.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So he came out, obviously, at that point in the world, 4-4-2 was, you know, everything.
The dominating
football.
Formation.
It's all really anybody did.
Ladies and gentlemen, England will be playing 4-4-2.
So here was an American coach with only a background in American college soccer, mm-hmm, as you like to call it. He came out and he was like, no, this national team is going to play 3-4-3. Loads of people had things to say about it. Quite, as you can imagine, condescending things, yeah, to say about it. Like, you know, well, you know, you can't do that in men's football, you know, blah, 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 all the rest of it. People thought, you're not playing a 4-4-2. What kind of tactical midgets are you?
Oh,
was
God,
as a quote. I don't even know what that's meant to mean. Mia Hamm said, we were to some extent irreverent because we didn't worship at the altar of 4-4-2. We didn't play the ball around in the back for half an hour to show we could possess it. I love this.
That's great.
We were different and we were scared teams because we were different and moved the ball forward quickly. Anson Dorrance qualified with an incredible 18-game winning streak.
Not bad, is it?
But incredibly, they did that. But then they stumbled in the World Cup warm-ups.
Here we go.
Now, we were just discussing World Cup warm-ups. Mm-hmm. Significantly, so they've gone 18 games without losing, and then they lost to both China and Norway.
Oh, that's very interesting.
In the 2 weeks before the tournament.
Yeah.
Norway was the team that they would actually meet in the final.
Yeah, Scandinavia have a really strong history in women's football,
yeah,
of being one of the, along with the US and Germany, basically that kind of, I was about to say trifecta, but I'm including Scandinavia, which
triple-edged sword.
Triple-edged sword, yeah, sure. That's good. That's good. Despite the fact that this one's got about six edges to it. Because Scandinavia is not one country.
Is Chinese for triple-edged sword.
That's, yeah. That's what I learned from Google. But yeah, like Scandinavian football, Denmark, Norway, Sweden in particular, have always taken it seriously.
So I mean, Norway was strong even last Euros, wasn't it?
Well, they've arguably got the world's greatest player behind kind of Alexi Putellas in Ada Hedeberg, who has been injured for a long time, but she left the Norway setup recently and only just came back because it wasn't professional enough.
Right,
interesting.
Okay.
But anyway, we're getting into modern times rather than 1991.
Look at you flexing your women's football muscles.
I know a little bit, and that's about as far as it goes. I'm not going to pretend I'm some expert. I just have dabbled.
You knew Mia Hamm?
I did, yeah. But I don't think I could tell you the rest of the US soccer team at this point.
Heinrichs, Jennings and Akers.
Oh, well, I thought it went without saying. We weren't going to mention the triple-edged sword.
The trifecta. The team, they got a well-deserved boost ahead of the final versus Norway with a Thanksgiving dinner, just jumping forward to the Norway game, with a Thanksgiving dinner that included players' families and a special guest, soccer legend Pelé.
He loves it, doesn't he?
But can you imagine that?
Incredible,
So they've made their way through the final, into the final. They're playing Norway. They sit down. It's the day before the final is Thanksgiving. So they sit down Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, where is that dinner?
Well, I was going to make the point that, like, Pelé hasn't just, like, gone to America, which he used to have, like, homes and property in. He's gone out to China to sit at this meal. Right. He sat down, when the starter coming out? Oh, you know, it's probably
in
the way to walk through the door, and then it's Pelé. It's like, what is going on? What are you doing here?
So surreal, isn't it? Like, they just, they can't call it the World Cup, but they can get Pelé there.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
That guy...
I tell you what, I don't think he's ever seen the invitation he's turned down, though, Pelé. Let's be honest. If you've got Benjamins...
We're both thinking of the same advert here, aren't we?
Yeah, oh, absolutely.
If men suffered, they suffered in silence. Not anymore, because millions of men have gotten help. That's 100 times the people here.
Stop your doctor. I would...
Yeah, he will endorse whatever you pay him to endorse. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Why am I here again? You do these.
Cool. After giving me ball, here I do these. Go.
Skip to victory. Anyway, so basically the story of the kind of making their way through the final is USA kill everybody. Norway kill everybody.
Yeah, that's just a steamroller.
It's pretty much what happened. It was nuts how one-sided the games were when those two teams were involved.
Yeah, sure. It's worth also saying, you might be touching on this, I don't really know, but it's also worth saying that sometimes we compare women's football to men's football because it's an easy parallel and people are generally speaking more aware of men's football, so it helps provide context. But it's also very unhelpful in certain areas. And one of these is talking about it, women's football, there's still a huge inequality between teams that are professional, teams that are semi-pro, teams that are amateur. Even nowadays, there are teams that are semi-professional in the championship of the women's football in England. So as an example, the second highest division in English football for women's is still predominantly semi-pro, if not amateur. It's absolutely incredible. So that's why so often that you'll see in women's football, or much more commonly, you'll see a 11-0 win, a 7-1 win, a 6-2 win, because there is a discrepancy between people that literally have full-time jobs and train twice a week, and they can still go and represent their country. The idea that you would get to a World Cup and not be a professional is quite alien to most of us. We assume that if you're there, it's because you're cream of the crop. But a lot of these players going to the first ever Women's World Cup would have been ranked amateurs, would have had full-time jobs.
And the majority of them,
yeah, exactly. Doubt, yeah. So it's always just worth giving that context of this isn't like the cream of the crop, every professional FA that's been established for 20, 30 years. These are countries and athletes that are having to represent their country despite basically never having done it full-time.
Well, it's
annual leave from their job.
Not dissimilar to some of the stories you hear, like in the Olympics, which is largely amateur sport, certainly in countries with less funding going on, where you hear these stories of like, you know, oh yeah, I made it through to the final, so I had to phone my boss and get an extra week off work.
Absolutely,
it's that
crazy.
Kind of thing.
It is, yeah.
Because it's football, you tend to go straight into massive production across, you know, broadcast audience of millions. That wasn't what was happening here.
Yeah.
You know, even the Americans, like over half of the squad were were part-time.
That's crazy.
So it is crazy. And it's important, I think, that you say that, because it also allows us to illustrate how it changes.
Yeah, sure.
Over time. Oh, not for everybody, but how it changes over time coming up to the World Cup this year. So anyway, back to this tournament. So we have Norway and we have America. America kind of stamped their "we're going to win this thing" with an unbelievably dominant display against Germany in the semi-final. They went 5-0 up and then took off two of the three triple-edged sword.
They were just left with sword.
Just sword was left on. And Germany pulled two consolation goals back, but the game was essentially done. Yeah. I mean, that's the semi-final. Like, Germany have won four games to get there,
mm-hmm.
or, contested four games and done well enough to get to the semi-finals, and they are thrown aside. And so what we have is probably a rightful thing, in the sense that Norway are facing America, is the two best teams, women's teams in the world, playing off in the first FIFA World Championship for women's football, the M&M's Cup.
Sponsored by M&M's.
Something like that. I can't even remember the name. I'm not even going to dignify it, FIFA.
What, you mean it wasn't immediately catchy? You can just let it roll off the tongue.
Yeah, exactly.
Outrageous.
Oh, dear. So anyway, with that, we have USA versus Norway in the first ever Women's World Cup.
You just cannot write scripts like this.
Okay, so the match itself saw 63,000 people pack That's into great. The Tiane Stadium for a Saturday night finale.
That's
so
brilliant.
For all the things that weren't right in terms of seeing this World Cup kind of play out, this seemed to be right. It's a Saturday night, 63,000 people there.
The demand has always been there. That's the whole point, is because it was devalued by the people that were in charge, it doesn't mean that it was devalued as a sport. People wanted to see it. People don't care. They just want to see good football. They want to see people at the top of their game competing. That's all it comes down to. But it was devalued by the money men, not by people that actually cared about the sport.
Exactly. So the 63,000 piled into the stadium to see 80 minutes.
80.
Interestingly, I just got a little note here on the report that led to that. So the 80 minutes thing was based on a report of the 1988 FIFA Women's Invitational Tournament, basically considered a dry run event for this tournament that was held in Norway. The report read, at that time, there were many teams whose players had serious fitness problems towards the end of an 80-minute game. So FIFA's kind of justification is, when we played 90-minute games, like, because almost the point you were just making, I'm not justifying it at all, but their thing was, your players, they're not fit enough because they're not doing it full-time, so they can't, manage it. Obviously, the players didn't like that at all, but that was their thinking behind it.
I understand the logic, but also they're happy enough to let 16-year-olds men play 90 minutes. Like these, but you are right in terms of, I'm sure there were fitness issues because people weren't able to train properly and kind of had to do it within their own time. But I do think it just sends the wrong signal.
Yeah,
like,
it's not
literally that the game would have been so bad the women would have been walking in the last 10 minutes. It just means that, it would have been tough. But in the same way, it's tough when, like, I'm an amateur, you're an amateur. When we're playing 90 minutes, you get to about 82 minutes, you're blowing.
Of course,
But I mean, it still minutes, shouldn't but... be,
yeah.
Oh, those are the days. Do you remember when we could run for 90 minutes? Do you remember?
Mate, they have. So I play cricket on the weekends, and they have this rule that if you're under 18, you can't bowl more than four overs in a row. And I'm like, if you're over 40, why am I allowed to?
Yeah, sure. Like, if you're under 18, you should be able to bowl as many as you want.
You've got the 16-year-old who's like running rings around me. I'm there, freaking eighth over, killing myself, like dislocated both knees.
Yeah, but that's why you're what is classed as a slow bowler. Not medium fast, not fast, you're just slow. Not even spin.
That's right. He's still on his run-up. Anyway, so other than that, we headed into the World Cup final. I'll call it that because I can't bother to keep repeating that stupid thing. So Michelle Akers, one of the triple-edged sword, headed in the free kick in the 20th minute from Shannon Higgins-Sorofsky to take the early lead for the USA. Many people predicting that USA would steamroller Norway in the same way they had the Germans.
Up goes Akers. Oh, a tremendous header. USA in the lead, Michelle Akers, ninth goal of the tournament with a header that rocketed past goalkeeper Seth.
But interestingly, Norway came back. And obviously Norway had beaten USA in pre-World Cup game. And so they drew from that a little bit, I think. And they drew even only 9 minutes later after the Akers goal through a Medlin header, which came off the post and kind of dribbled in. It wasn't a particularly attractive goal, but Norway knew that they were in a game.
Yeah.
The game became tight as the magnitude of the prize became clear to both teams. Higgins-Rofsky commented afterwards, everyone got tense. We said at halftime that we needed to just get in behind them and play in a different way. They were shutting us down far too easily for the last 20 minutes of the first half. So this is a team that had won 18 games in a row, those World Cups, 18 games in a row, beaten everybody before them, won the invitational tournament in Norway, absolutely no problem at all. And suddenly they were in a game that I guess symbolised everything about what the future of their sport might be about. And they realised that they needed to change things. So Dorrance, the coach, as we've talked about before, he changed things around. However, Higgins-Sarovsky, after playing the entire tournament with a fifth metatarsal stress fracture in her left foot, it was her that would ultimately set up what would be the winner.
Fair play.
Incredible, isn't
it? Yeah, like amazing stuff.
David Beckham, Wayne Rooney.
My metatarsals hurting.
Becca's prey.
That's a good reference. So Higgins-Sarovsky, injured playing throughout the whole tournament. She delivers an unbelievable 40-yard pass in the 78th minute. So she only had two minutes of energy left. At this point.
That's all she needed, That's all she needed.
So if this is injury time, she'd have been on the floor. Collapsed. 78th minute, 40-yard pass, brilliant, which Norway probably should have cleared, but instead Michelle Akers forced her way with great strength to go past the defenders and then round the keeper. Then on facing an empty net, it was on her left-hand side, mm-hmm. facing an empty net, she then kind of weirdly switched the ball from her naturally facing left foot to use her stronger right foot. Which a lot of people were like, what were you doing?
Yeah.
Like, it was a real kind of like, oh my word. She just got away with it.
Yeah.
She said afterwards, I got so much grief about that from both my teammates, the coach, and then the press. She said about the maneuver before explaining, from practicing, if the ball is rolling away to the left and you hit it with your left, unless you hit it perfectly, there is a margin of error I wasn't willing to take.
Love that.
On my right, I had the ball width to hit it to go in. I just passed it into the goal. No issue.
And with the match seemingly destined for extra time, it was Michelle Akers again to write her name into the history books.
She has the presence of mind in a World Cup final, having rounded the goalkeeper, to still do the, like, it's like the Zach Galifianakis meme of all the angles and numbers moving around. Yeah, she's just right. Like, right, margin of error, okay. And that is amazing composure.
It is.
Fair play.
She says, so this is 2 minutes to go, they get the winner. She said, I knew exactly what I was doing. I wasn't going to miss, and I had the time to switch. To score the winner in the World Cup, who gets that chance? I wasn't going to miss out.
Love that.
So Michelle Akers scores the winner, and USA do what maybe many, many people said they probably would do, but it was a lot harder than they were expecting. Norway ran them close, and they came away winning 2-1, only winning the game in the last couple of minutes. So USA won the first World Cup.
Well, you have just witnessed 90 of the most gripping minutes of European football you will ever, ever see. The good news is there's more to come.
It's a real strange kind of pressure, though, isn't it? That's one thing in particular where when you're that heavy favourites, it's a whole new mind game, and it's a whole new level of pressure to kind of live and cope with.
And I don't think we... Maybe we have it a little bit with Man City in the Premier League, but I'm trying to think of a time where they would have been that outright favourites.
Yeah.
You have teams you think will win it.
Yeah.
But you just don't, certainly in men's major tournament football, you don't have that. There's too many things going on. And obviously over time, USA weren't always that runaway favourites. But even going into this World Cup that's coming up now, I know England beat them or drew last year. They beat them, didn't they?
The USA?
Yeah.
Yeah, beat them.
Obviously in England. Yeah. But there's an element where they're still, quite heavily favoured.
Yeah, definitely.
To win the tournament.
Yeah. Yeah,
which is an interesting thing. The aftermath of the World Cup is there's some stuff to kind of worth reflecting on as we kind of moved into this new era of regularly scheduled women's tournaments, which up until this point hadn't happened. The perceived success of the tournament, mainly on the attendance of the final, was a significant factor in the subsequent inclusion of women's football in the 1996 Summer Olympics. Interestingly, I mean, this was a major thing. I'm sure you'll cover this a little bit, but the fact that women's football made it into the Olympics is a major stepping stone.
Yeah.
And it was talked like that. And there was still, there was still kind of like whispers of, this actually isn't a marketable brand. It was reported that although attendances were very high in the World Cup, many tickets were complimentary.
Right.
And so there was arguments again from the people that have got to make these decisions that actually it's a bit misleading.
Yeah.
You know, 63,000 people weren't ticket paying people.
Yeah, sure.
The novelty factor of women from foreign lands playing football also encouraged local people to attend. Literally in FIFA's report.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. That is so crazy.
So strange, isn't it? But anyway, following the USA win, the team travelled for nearly a day before landing in New York on December the 2nd to a quiet reception consisting of several US soccer officials, US men's national team head coach Bora Milanutovic, and three news reporters, one photographer and Swiss air officials. Isn't that crazy?
Just understated. Champions of the world, and it's just a few local officials saying, well done.
But I should add that those Swiss air officials each gave a player a rose.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, so, I mean,
you know.
That makes up for the street parade.
That's it. I mean, who needs Gazza with a massive pair of plastic tits? You know?
I think we all need Gazza and a plastic pair of tits.
When you get a rose from a Swiss air official. So again, to illustrate the difference in, you know, like even the men's World Cup, and make the Gazza point, that was the year before in terms of what, you know, the men's game and then women's, you know, they win the World Cup.
Yeah.
The most dominant team, you know, in the world by far, and they come home to about 20 people.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah, really interesting. Stark, crazy. Julie Foudy, the Hall of Fame midfielder who played in that game, she said, "We came home to nothing. No one knows, no one cares." Which
brutal, became what quite, come down.
Yeah, it also became quite an iconic quote for motivating some of the stuff I've read, which not necessarily in this report because it's talking about future, but that was a almost like a starting point quote. We are going to make this a game that people care about. We came home to nothing. No one knows. No one cares. She went on to win two World Cups and three Olympic medals during her national team career. There was at this point, no second World Cup planned.
Absurd. Absolutely absurd.
So this was literally just, let's just
an
do
experiment.
It and see what happens.
Yeah.
So they hadn't thought at all about, like, you know, putting it in or anything like that. She said again, this is April Heinrichs, one of the Triple Edged Sword.
Yeah.
The ache was real and the departures at the airport, you're just hugging on and hanging on to your teammates saying goodbye. We didn't want this to end. Heinrichs, who played forward and served as the US team captain in 1991, added, "I was close to many of them, but it really did feel like the end, not the beginning of women's soccer."
Wow.
"It felt like the end of one team's journey with a whole lot of uncertainty about the game. We left the airport not knowing if we would ever play together again." World Cup champion. It's so crazy, isn't it?
It is bizarre.
Just
absolutely. What a horrible position to be in, to have the high on the pitch of winning the World Cup and then coming home to that depressing like low. It's, what a roller coaster.
Absolutely. Julie Foudy again, commenting, she also remembers the resolve that began to bubble up in the team in the squad at that moment, thinking, "This isn't going to be easy, but we are going to get this sport off the ground in this country." And that was our attitude, and that carried on with the Olympics in a few years, the World Cup, and then the Olympics in the following years. To say they succeeded, and we'll finish with this, to say they succeeded is an understatement. The US WNT is now the most successful international squad in women's soccer, winning four World Cups in 91, 99, 2015 and 2019, four Olympic gold medals, 96, 2004, 2008, 2012, and nine CONCACAF, thank you, gold cups. And as a kind of teaser for where we're heading with this thing, viewership figures for the 2019 Women's World Cup, so what, 30 years later, not even 30 years, 28 years later, soared as 1.12 billion people tuned into coverage of the tournament.
Amazing.
What? Like 28 years. That's incredible, isn't it?
Absolutely amazing.
So yeah, there we go. That was the first ever FIFA World Championship for Women's Football for the M&M's Cup.
I'm sure they all had it tattooed on them as winning members of the squad. They all just got that title and then a picture of a blue M&M just tattooed on their arms. But thanks, Ad. That was illuminating, fascinating, and I'm excited to get through the rest of this series. So we hope, ladies and gentlemen, that you will join us as we continue our look next week.